Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Truth of Happiness Dhamma study, Sangha discussion on the wisdom factors of the Eightfold Path and Dhamma talk that introduces the fifth week study of the virtuous factors of the path. This was recorded on January 14th, 2017 at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. Even a quiet meditation room is impermanent. Jen, how is your Dhamma study going, and your study in particular of right view and right intention?
So I guess really I've realized this week that just I've had it on my brain, and you know, right view is seeing clearly what's happening right now. And right intention is the intention to see clearly what is happening right now, mm-hmm. in every moment. Wow. And that means every moment.
Yeah.
I have to bring myself back to what's happening right now. Yeah. Sometimes that's easier than others. Sometimes I don't mind bringing myself back to what's happening right now, especially when I'm very focused at work. Other times when I'm like when I'm driving, even when I'm driving here, which is a beautiful drive, it's like a plethora of hot air balloon rides in my mind. Like each stream of consciousness is just another hot air balloon ride. And all I have to do is grab onto the string, and I'm just taken away to a sky of irrelevance and thoughts and just distraction. And then I'm just coming, and then I have to just come back to what's happening now and observing what's the trees going by and the sky. And yeah, it's like every moment I choose to come back to what's happening now. And there's peace, definitely peace in that.
Thank you for saying that. That metaphor is just great. Hot air balloons. I've often been told that my thoughts amount to a lot of hot air.
Really?
And usually those comments are correct. So. You're also speaking to the impermanence of things. And that's the important thing to notice about, there's no such thing as a fixed present moment, but to notice the impermanence of each moment is the profound teaching of the Dhamma. And when you look at it that way, you could say that right view is a view that completely understands the impermanent nature of all things. That's what Kandana declared when he awakened, and the Buddha said, yeah, you got it. And right intention then provides the direction to be mindful of impermanence unfolding in our life. And the underlying aspect of right intention is to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. And of course, craving and clinging arises from trying to establish a permanent self in an impermanent environment.
Oh boy.
That happened once and it didn't stop as much. That's good. I'm glad that was very impermanent. Thank you so much for that. It's a great metaphor. Kevin, good morning.
Just wanted to thank you for, you know, the way your teachings are very direct and organized and sort of able to keep on the path of the study because of the way you sort of cataloged it. So, you know, there's a couple interruptions with the snow or I didn't make it here, but still been sticking with it and doing it again. And it's neat how this path sort of reveals something or something comes to the surface, becomes more visible. Particularly with right view, as it's been said, it's the beginning and the entry point and the, you know, sort of culmination.
Yeah.
And it's helped me discover on the path where, you know, I might be, maybe not completely following the path. And, you know, something that's been sort of sticking out to me in this whole journey is one of my teachers told me, discovering the truth is life's greatest adventure. I would probably say awakening to the truth is life's greatest gift, and embodying the truth is life's greatest offering. And the embodiment of the truth and you know, sort of this path has kind of led me through Right View to understand that maybe I have sort of this sevenfold path going on. And you know, one factor in particular that we'll talk about next week has been sort of something on this path and discovery of, you know, over 5 years of sort of effort and work. Have to keep coming back to the practice, like Jenny said, in each moment to be here, because I can't get ahead of myself. It's not here yet, but it's getting close, and this is really where the practice comes into. These are, you know, it's very close. I think I can feel something happening, you know, as far as what I've been putting out there and working on, but can't get ahead of myself, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just really appreciative to be here, and thanks for the Sangha support.
Thank you for what you said. We were talking a little bit about that earlier before class today, about how as you deepen your understanding of the practice, the Eightfold Path and where it's taking us, the implications are then become pretty profound. And you recognize that what we're dealing with is our most, to use the word, the most sacred beliefs, the things that we hold most dear and the things that are most challenging to us to let go of. And you pointed to next week's teaching of the concentration factors of the Eightfold Path and how important right effort is to get us past that. And, of course, even right effort builds over time. The more we experience the efficacy of the Dhamma, the more we have that right intention, we're able to maintain that, to continue, and then deal with some of the biggest issues that we carry with us. So thank you for pointing that out. We'll get more to come. Becky, good to see you this morning. Thank you for sewing up the Zafu.
Right Intention, Right View, chapter in the book, felt that it seemed a little abstract to me. I wasn't, you know, because I'm new, because of that, I just felt like I didn't, like, really, like, feel it. And I went through the week. I meditated maybe 3 times, and I absolutely could not get anywhere. I felt like my mind was just a racing mass of crap. And no matter what I did, you know, I came back to my breath like a million times. And I could never get Jen explains it so well when she has all these metaphors, but I don't have those metaphors.
That was a pretty good one you had.
That was really good. Don't compare to me.
So finally, last night, I sat down at the end of the day to meditate, and I sort of opened my eyes again, and 15 minutes had gone by, and I just felt like it was going to be possible for me to use this in some way to make my life better, but I wasn't, that's all, I just felt better. I just felt better.
Yeah.
But when I do, like now, this meditation that we had just now, was very insightful for me. Because sometimes what happens is I feel all of a sudden like overcome, and it sometimes brings tears to my eyes, by the realization that it's all right to let things go. And that's just really big for me. So
that's what I have to say.
That's a lot. And most of it wasn't crap at all. That was beautiful. Becky, you're, and Jen too, you're speaking to the heart of the matter. For one thing, you're recognizing that even our meditation sessions themselves are impermanent in the way they feel and what we experience. When it feels like nothing's going on, what do? Come back to the sensation of breathing. And it leads to a profound experience that you had. Yeah, this can work for me. That we talked a little bit about that in reference to what Kevin said too. We recognize through our own experience how powerful these teachings are and where they can take us. But in a very gentle way, at our own pace, when we're ready to do it. The only thing we really need is the proper framework and continued right effort to keep doing it. You know, and it all speaks to the impermanence of all things. The third noble truth, that cessation of this ongoing process that we put ourselves through of creating additional stress in our lives, states that it is possible to bring that to cessation. In a way, you could say that, well, that's the most important noble truth, isn't it? Because if the Buddha said there's a lot of stress in your life, you add to it by craving and clinging, and there's no way out, what are we doing here? But he said the most important thing, there's a way out. And he didn't stop there. He went one more step, the most important step. Well, I just said the third was the most important step. But the next most important step is the way out, the Eightfold Path. And I can't remember the word you used, abstract. When we first come, it took me a long, long time just to remember the words that referred to the Eightfold Path. Forget about developing it. It's not that they're abstract in a absolute way. In other words, once we understand it, they're not abstract. But because they so contradict the way we want to see the world, they seem so far away from us. They seem abstract. They seem impractical even.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
But as we develop, and it doesn't take long to start seeing the efficacy. This is the second time I use that word. I don't know why it's stuck in my mind today. Once you see it, then you have a greater enthusiasm to continue. Again, that's why the Buddha always came back to using this word ehipasiko. Come and see for yourself. But what he's really saying is you must see for yourself. Try this on and you'll see. And it'll give you the enthusiasm and the right intention to keep going. So thank you for bringing that up. Eva, good to see you this morning.
It's really great to be here with everyone. My meditation practice has always been really nothing that you can pinpoint. You know, some weeks or some days are better and some are non-existent as far as even doing meditation. I try, but it just doesn't, it doesn't always work. However, I do get a lot of benefit when I do it, and that's a wonderful thing. As far as intention, right intention, to use another story, let's say I'm going out somewhere and I'm going to meet or be with some people, and there's something that is a little niggling problem, so I say to myself, I'm not going to bring it up. And I walk in, and that's the first thing I do is I bring it up. And so my intention, which was not to do it, somehow, it just by thinking about it, it just kind of threw it right in the front of me, so I had to, you know, pick it up and carry it through. And that's often what I find with my meditation and with everything else. I have the intention, I have the view that I know that it's the right thing to do, and yet, you know, I'll just still go and do something else, and it makes me wonder why, and I have no answer, so I just say, you know, just to try to be gentle. Good. Just not to give it a rating, you know, oh, I did good, I didn't do well, I whatever, let's just move on. This is what happened, let's see if I can do something else the next time. And I've been coming many, many years, it still is hard.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. And again, your description of right intention shows that you're developing it perfectly. You're recognizing because you're holding that intention when you don't follow through with it. And that's really the most important thing. It's not that we're an immediate success at this. It's that we recognize where change needs to take place. And a few years ago, you wouldn't have noticed that because you didn't have the framework for seeing it clearly, where things need to change. And the fact that we think something, and even though we might have this underlying feeling, I shouldn't say it, but we say it anyway, is a great description of conditioned thinking, which says mm-hmm. basically that because I think something, that must be the way it is. Mm-hmm. You just can't hold yourself back, you know. And getting back to what we talked about earlier today, it getting to the heart of the matter is getting at all of our self-referential views, not just the obvious ones that we begin with, but when you really get to these subtle aspects, most people would never think about what you just described, even that I thought about not saying something, but I said it anyway. You wouldn't have a reference or even recognizing mm-hmm. that. In that instance, you have no control of your thinking, you know, or you have no control of your actions either. And that'll lead to what I'm going to talk about today, too. So thank you. Jay, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to see you. Pretty good, thank you. Meditation is okay. I seem to be able to cope with keeping past thoughts and present thoughts that are disturbing out of the picture. But I wind up fretting about future things, mm-hmm. you know, what's going to happen in the spring, you know, and what's going to happen with this and what's going to happen with that. It's a waste of time, I suppose, but I've always done it, you yeah. know, and can't seem to stop doing it. But I have been reading the selections in the book and trying to make sense, and bit by bit I get some understandings here and there, you know. Don't have much else to say except that I'm still studying and, you know, I'm just still got my toe in the water with all this. It's, you know, it's very new to me. And, I know a lot more about Hinduism than I do about Buddhism. And I keep kind of thinking about things in those terms with the, you know, good deities and bad deities and yeah. things like that. And it's just going to take me a while, but I'm on the case.
Oh, yeah. And from your questions and comments, you're on the right case. There's quite a bit of difference between Hinduism and what the Buddha taught. Again, that's not a reflection on Hinduism, it's just different. Mm-hmm. And what you're, the idea of coming to that understanding is also part of the Dhamma, recognizing what it is and what it isn't. And again, it's not a reflection on anything that it isn't, it's in order to develop, you have to see what it is very clearly. And that takes a little bit of time, too. And you're developing it perfectly. So I'm glad you're here. Lisa, good to see you this morning.
Well, why can't I find 20 minutes in the morning and in the afternoon to meditate?
Conditioned thinking. How's that for a quick answer?
I'm not making the right effort. So, but I'm doing some. But it's easy for me to beat myself up over, you know, an infinite number of things, actually.
Yeah.
So just pick and choose. So I am doing some of that, and I think if I did more, it would really be much more helpful for me learning what is going on here. I read about right view, and I read it several times trying to understand it. Then I went to go on to right intention, and I just couldn't get it. And I just couldn't move on. I'm trying to understand right view, and it's just that I'm a concrete person. For me to learn something, I have to actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't watch somebody and I can't listen to someone because it just goes right through.
Yep.
It's like I can't hear you. I can't do that. I have to actually do the thing you're doing. I have to do it with my hands. And so it's concrete. This stuff is not, it's not really concrete. It's very, you know, it's mental. It's amorphous. I don't know what it is. It's clouds. You know, they're always just constantly changing. And I read right. try to think of it as, to make it concrete for me, is view is like to see. So we seeing things. You look around and I see things. And those things have an impact on my mind. And, you know, right view has some, you know, I think it has something to do with that.
Yes.
I don't know what, though. You know, sometimes I see things, I want to draw them, but I'm not an artist. I never got beyond the stick figure. I still draw stick figures. But, you know, children, up to a certain point, they're so uninhibited. They have art in class, and they draw anything and everything. And, you know, kids' art is great. I like it better than the masters because of where it's coming from. Children, they don't have the inhibitions, and they draw, you know, great things right from their... So, you know, so even if I can't draw, I still do some drawing, or I see something like that wall. Like, I'd like to draw that those bricks. I don't know why. Sometimes I look at something and said I want to draw it. And that's what this is. It's doing something that you know you can't do well or you don't understand, but you try to do it anyway.
Yeah, I would say that's a pretty good way of putting in the beginning. So you're describing something that everybody, Becky was just talking about it. When you first come across these teachings, they do seem very abstract, they seem very amorphous. It seems, well, how does this really apply? Until you understand that to be the beginning of this is the beginning of right view is recognizing that some of your views may not be a right view. And using view in this sense, it is what we see, but it's really the way we see ourselves in relation to the world. That takes a while to develop. And so this is, you're at the entry point. You're just walking into the door and you're assessing what's in the room. It takes a while to bring everything in and to be comfortable with it, and then to start really putting it into implementation where we have an actual experience, where we can feel what it's like to do this. So I'm going to put Kevin on the spot. When you first heard the Eightfold Path, it seemed pretty abstract and you didn't understand how to apply it. But as you continue with your practice, you saw very clearly this is how it works. So if you notice how the book starts with everything you need to know. Dukkha occurs. But we can't accept that yet. We have to go through a process of developing an understanding, a profound understanding of what that really means. And the first words in the book aren't dukkha occurs, so don't start thinking, where did I miss? But that's really where it begins. And when the Buddha described a fully awakened, fully mature human being in relation to right view, he stated it this way: right view understands stress. Doesn't even sound like it's worth the effort, does it, until we understand how profound our engagement with the stress in our lives is. It's a complete... Another way that the Buddha could have nearly as accurately described dukkha as saying there is distraction in our life because we spend our lives so distracted because of our preoccupation with dukkha. So you're at the beginning phase of developing a way of seeing that. And first, it is a mental exercise or an intellectual exercise. That's how we learn as human beings. We first take things in through thought, whether it's an object that we're describing to ourselves or an idea that we're trying to get a hold of. But the Buddha didn't stop right there. He didn't just explain what this is like, what the world is like, what dukkha is like. He gave us a way of developing our own understanding because he understood that abstract ideas are just another distraction, no matter what it is. It could be the most profound truth in the universe, dukkha occurs. But unless we understand it, it's meaningless. And so he gave us a way, a path, an eightfold path, that we develop, we integrate it into our lives, and then it becomes a framework for how we develop profound right view. And so you're at the beginning stage. As you continue, you'll see what it feels like and how to implement it. But of course, you have to go through it first. The book is written in a way that each weekly study lays the foundation for what will be the next week's study. And it's often the next week's study that explains what you just learned. But that's I spent a lot of time deciding which chapter would and which week would be where. And this is the result of it. So one chapter leads to the next chapter. As you get towards the later chapters, you'll start understanding even more how right view and right intention fit in with the whole practice. That's really the way. The book is written in the way that the Buddha also taught the Dhamma. He didn't teach, for instance, week 8 is on dependent origination. Dependent origination is what the Buddha awakened to. Why didn't I teach it first? Because there's no context for understanding it at all. But at least towards the 8th week of study, we have a framework in which to place those teachings in. And ultimately, dependent origination is something we spend our whole lives learning what that means. So thank you for bringing it up. You're also right. Be very, very gentle with yourself for exactly this reason. At times it can seem like it's just impossible. But it's only impossible in relation to our conditioned thinking. You know, that's really the resistance. The idea that you haven't been able to sit successfully for 20 minutes at a time twice a day, I threw that out pretty quickly, but I didn't mean it in a flippant way. It is because of conditioned thinking that we have such resistance to just sitting. Imagine somebody saying, you have to sit quietly for 20 minutes. Well, I can do that until you try to do it, and then it's really difficult for most of us. So it takes time to, because of that, our conditioned response to, I can't sit, I have too many things to do, my mind is too busy, I got to get to this, I got to get to that. That's a conditioned response. As your mind starts to deepen in concentration through meditation, then you can gradually add some time because you're not so resistant to it. So be very gentle with yourself. 2 or 3 or 5 minutes is fine. At least everybody that comes to my class starts there rather than too long of a meditation session that's just impossible. So, thank you. I'm glad you're here. Liz, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you guys. This is Ram 2 for me, going through the book with you, and it is really amazing how you've been able to develop this whole program around the direct teachings of the Buddha. I've been involved with Buddhism for a while, and there are some ways that it can be described that are not very clear at all. So this is very much appreciated. It's really been a profound experience for me. My practice is going well. As a way to enter phase 2, I've been focusing on more of the discipline of with every element of the Eightfold Path that we discuss, I have this structure set up in my mind that everything goes back to these four elements, the Four Noble Truths. So whenever we talk about the, right view and right intention, I take it back to the first three Noble Truths and just sort of play around with that in my mind. And it takes away so much of the confusion of what are these eight elements, what is the importance to them in this practice that I have. So I've been working on the understanding of the reality of the dissatisfaction in life. As it relates to so many things, and not seeing it as so much of a negative as just what is. And so that's been a really helpful thing for me because it takes away the burden of responsibility that I've placed on myself to provide solutions to all the pain and suffering in the world. So that's been a relief. So things are going well. I have never been as unbusy in my mind and in my occupation as I am right now, and I'm trying to sort of settle into that feeling of not being busy as a way to help with, the busyness of my mind that I've lived with my whole life. So it's something to get used to. Whenever I get into a situation where I start asking why did this happen or why did that? It's the comfort of the Four Noble Truths that I go back to, that I can say that it, the question isn't why, the question is answered in the sitting and in the practice and in the study. So for that I am grateful.
I am too for saying that. It's in the practice that we get our understanding and get our answers that we're having. You know, is this really worth it? Is it true? You have to have. I mean, anybody, you can describe a truth to anybody. You can just say, an apple is delicious. Well, until you take a bite of the apple, you don't know for yourself, and it doesn't do you any good to take my word on it. You might not even like apples. And the other thing that you said about wanting to end the suffering in the world, that whole idea contradicts what the Buddha said. You can't. Dukkha occurs. It's going to occur no matter what we do. And it points to the lack of understanding. I don't even want to go there anymore because I go there too often. But it's important to recognize that if we're going to end suffering in the world, it starts with us. It doesn't start outside of ourselves. We need to do it with ourselves first. And then we're in a much better position to address the common problems of humanity. And then we realize some of the things that we simply have no control over, sickness, aging, and death. Not getting what we want, getting what we don't want. Those are part of life. We can't bring them to cessation. But we can bring to cessation our own need for that to be different than it is, for reality to be different than it is. So, thank you, Liz. Lorna, good to see you this morning.
When I was reading Right View, Right Intention, it occurred to me that it really is the daily bread and butter of the law I need to do for my own practice. Be mindful of craving and clinging and aversion. Just recently I'm being more mindful of aversion, that I'm avoiding something and doing something else to avoid something. So I'm more conscious of aversion than I used to be, and spotting it throughout the day. And as I said, when I was reading Right View, Right Intention, and looking at craving and clinging and aversion, it really hit me that it's right at the beginning of the Dharma. And it's really a lot of the major work that we have to do in our lives to have a quieter mind is all wrapped up in that. You know, in the aversion and I know that the rest of the Dharma, the Eightfold Path, is still to come, but the hard part is right at the beginning. And the first time I went through the book, I don't think I really got what craving, clinging, and aversion is, and really the work that we have to do in ourselves to follow the Eightfold Path. I didn't really get it. And actually now, looking back, I'm really fortunate because it's so hard. It's so hard to look at your own views and accept it's a silly thing. It's just a view. There's no need for it. And just to abandon it. And that sounds easy to do, but it really, really isn't. And that's the daily bread and butter of the Dharma. You've referred to dependent origination, and I know we need to understand dependent, but then once you understand it, you can just lay it to the back of your mind and you don't really have to look at it every day.
Yeah.
But the right view is it's a lot of work. And I'm appreciating it now the second time around looking at the book. I'm appreciating that now more than I did the first time. I understand it more. So, that's it really. That's it.
Thank you. That was ehipasiko. Come and see for yourself. The first time through it, you don't even really know how to apply it. But as you deepen it, we've talked about this a lot today. As you deepen your understanding, you see how it's applied. You understand that craving and aversion is two sides of the same coin. You know, aversion is just is craving that something be different than it is. And even as we deepen our understanding and start looking at our own aversions, a lot of times those things that we realize that we're averse to are the same, are things that we're also holding very dear. In other words, we really want to hold on to them even though we don't like them because we've created an identity. And we need to look at it. We need to look at it in the right framework. And it's always an ongoing process. Again, that's how it's presented to us. So thank you for bringing that up. Debbie, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to see you too. Well, my mind is just so full after this class. Yeah. I feel like there's been so much said here today.
There has.
It's kind of like amazing. And
you can listen to it again.
You can listen to it again.
I will. The whole thing. But anyway, I'm on my first round, and it's just like I've related to so many things that people have said, so that my mind keeps going about thinking about all these things that go in a journal or something. So, I guess for me, you know, I really was relating to it. It's Eva, right? Said about the intention. I really struggle with that. Like sometimes I just know in my gut this isn't the right thing to do. I need to have a better intent. So I intend not to say it to someone, whatever I'm going to say, and then I say it anyway. And it's like, obviously, I'm so hooked into the frustration or whatever that brings me to happen to talk about that with someone. And then, then it's horrible feeling afterwards if you hurt somebody or...
Yeah.
You know, said something that was, it's not loving or kind. So, and then not to beat yourself up about it, but to try to, deal with my own self-anger or frustration with myself. And, so, that's something. And then in terms of how I see this, like the view, the right view, the right intention, I see it literally, like how I'm taking it in. It's like right view. It's like, how am I seeing things? Is it the right way? Is it, what's my perspective? And am I aware of my perspective? And am I trying to force my perspective on someone else, And part of the right view is like letting go sometimes of my, seeing that perspective, recognizing it doesn't have to be everybody's perspective and that I have different perspectives. With that literally and also the intention that, I really relate to what you said about that's kind of the meat and potatoes of it. It's really, this feels like the real guts of the work I have to do to look at how I'm viewing things and my intentions and having good intentions and loving intention for myself and others too, I wish it was easier though, it's hard work, right? I guess is what I'm realizing. I mean, it's simple in some ways. It's very simplistic, and yet it's not. The work of change and change isn't so easy.
Yeah, it isn't. The teachings, when you really understand them, are very simple and very direct. But the persistence is, we need a lot of it. There's a word, kashanti, which means patient forbearance. We need a lot of kashanti to keep going because we're always coming up against our conditioned thinking. And conditioned also implies that we don't want to let go of it. It's become part of us. The sole reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path is to overcome conditioned thinking. The beginning of the Eightfold Path is right view. That puts the fine point on, wow, It's really what the way I'm looking at things that's the problem, and it really is. When the Buddha used that term, the three marks of existence, impermanence, anicca, not self, anatta, and dukkha, suffering, those are the three things the Buddha said are common to all humanity. These are the things that we have to go through, or that we embody, as Kevin used the word. when he used the term anatta, what he was saying was that, and again, wildly misunderstood to imply that there's no such thing of a self, the Buddha never said that. He says it's your views of that you're using to describe a self to yourself that are not a self. Meaning, you got to let go of the views. How can you let go of your views? First, you have to know where they're coming from. You have to know. You have to have a framework for recognizing when your ego is taking over a situation rather than an authentic self that is resting in understanding. And that's the difficult part. We don't want to let go of it. It feels like annihilation. It feels like I'm letting go of everything that I hold dear, when really the only thing you're letting go of is everything that contributes to your own stress and unhappiness. Let it go. What's left? Reality. Lasting peace and happiness no matter what's occurring. And you're right. This is a great example of a well-focused sangha. There's a lot that we've talked about that is basic and fundamental to understanding it. You know, it's really remarkable.
I also wanted to say, it's Becky. I think that when you were saying how hard meditation was in your, all the crap and stuff, which I said, and having to come back to the breath. I just wanted to say that I think that's so wonderful that at least you're seeing it and coming back.
Yeah.
Coming back. And that's the strengthening of the mind for me. That it, because I always have that monkey mind. It's like coming back makes me feel good. At least you're getting aware.
At least
you
have a place to go.
Right. Yeah.
Because sometimes I'm not getting aware. If you're aware, then at least you're coming back, and that's the good news,
Yeah. What you describe me is exactly what you need to look at and let go of. But that's the point where many, many people get frustrated and say it's not for me, because they're really lacking the framework and understanding that this isn't because I'm frustrated or bored. Really, boredom is at the root of that frustration. I need more distraction. I can't stand this. At the root of that is wanting ourselves to be different than we are in that moment, meaning I'm meditating and my mind isn't cooperating. It's just what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can recognize it that way, I don't want to do this, but for the next 3 minutes I'm going to, you're deconditioning your conditioned response to not do it. But it's so hard to even understand that one point. I can't meditate because I can't meditate. Well, you got to try it. You got to actually, if you want to, anybody can do it. Anybody can sit quietly and be mindful of their breath for a few minutes. But if you have a lot of resistance to it, it seems like it's the hardest thing in the world. But think about it. I'm a human being. I'm going to sit here and just think about my breath for a few minutes. Wait a minute, I can't. I got to be somewhere else in my mind right now rather than where I am. That's dukkha.
Yeah.
I cannot accept myself in the way I'm thinking in this moment. And what's peace? I can accept myself in the way I'm thinking in this moment. Kevin, you're going to say something.
Yeah, sometimes, what I've been hearing a lot is, because this is an abstract teaching or it's large and that's sort of what this truth, is, I think that we go back to the first chapter, the yellow book, when you describe what Chamatha Vipassana is, and it's sort of this training and this mechanical process, because if we think about all of this dependent origination and this conditioned thinking and views, there it's kind of a mechanical process. Your mind works in this sequence, right? There's gears that dependent origination from craving and clinging, and it kind of works like that. But this physical task of meditating, of shamatha vipassana, of quieting your mind for 2 minutes, 1 minute, 20 minutes, an hour, whatever it is that you do, probably less in the beginning, The 3 minutes every morning that you do starts to break that mechanical process of thought. And then it becomes visible. Then you're able to understand this context. It doesn't become as far-reaching or abstract. It's right in front of you because the process is interrupted by the breath. And that, I think, is important. And sometimes when we're, because this class has gotten out there, and in a good way, and lucky to have that. But that, what we just did for 20 minutes, you interrupted your mind from conditioned views, thinking that starts to interrupt the life experience, this present moment, because we're going places. It's
I like what you said.
It's
about
like a quantum effect, but this mechanical thing of just sitting down daily.
It's like when you're not doing meditation, the mechanics of your mind, it's like each thought is so close and bound to every other thought.
Clinging.
Yes.
There's no space.
So stuck, there's no space, literally, in the ears. And if you can just sit down and breathe, even if your thoughts are still going, you can just sit down and breathe, it will loosen them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the spaciousness that people talk about in meditation. And you're exactly right. That is a...
You just have to trust.
The ultimate clinging that we have, that we come up against, is clinging one thought to the next thought, to the next thought, to the next thought. And we don't allow any space for reality. Every thought then is a self-referential thought that confirms the previous thought. In other words, we're just leading our... And if the problem is ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and we don't have any way to interject something that's not ignorant, that's founded in reality, the only thing that can continue is ignorant views, no matter how real we make them. And Kevin put it beautifully. The purpose of meditation, of deepening concentration, is to interrupt that process of ongoing conditioned thinking, clinging one thought to the next. In a very practical and direct way, sitting quietly, recognizing that I'm caught up in my conditioned thinking again, coming back to the sensation of breathing, interrupts the conditioned thinking.
On your own, too.
On your own.
Epiphysico, like the nexus point is the Shamatha Vipassana meditation, of the Dhamma and the truth, the right view, as far-reaching as it is. It's like this is where it happens, on the cushion.
That's where the rubber meets the road.
And epiphysico and right view, it's like it comes right here every time you're doing this.
But, and when we can bring it into our... into our meditation practice, meaning a deep, well-concentrated mind, then we can take that mind off of our meditation cushion and bring it into the rest of our lives, which is where the framework of the Eightfold Path blooms. Exactly why the Buddha... And when you really understand that, you understand the problems of just meditating without a framework. I say it so often, I wish more people would listen to me, because I'm right. when we meditate without the proper framework, what's most likely going to occur is we're just going to continue our own conditioned thinking because we have no framework to see it. We're just reinforcing that conditioned thinking. And the Buddha recognized that too. That's why he didn't teach just meditation. In fact, he taught meditation as the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, not the first. Of course, everything is rooted in meditation. We need the other seven factors to develop profound right view that's rooted in deep concentration. What a great class. Ellie, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good. I'm reminded, sitting here, something you said in response to Liz, how important it is, not just for each of us individually, regardless of where we are on the path, to be doing this, how good it is for ourselves individually and for the world as a whole. I've been also thinking about, realizing, of course, I can't control the world, I can't control the country, I can't control anything. So what could I do in my own corner of the world that could make my community a better place? But I wasn't really thinking of meditation. I was thinking about other things, outward things. Which is great, and I'm doing those things, but it's good to remember that just this whole process of seeking to reduce stress and seeking to find lasting peace and happiness is not just good for us as individuals.
Oh, yeah.
It has a ripple effect throughout our communities.
I agree so completely. I know you hear me say it often, the most loving thing I can do for myself and for everyone else is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. Because then whatever contributions I make to the world at large, and I hope they're significant, they're rooted in a true understanding of the way the world works, not instilling additional stress in other people by insisting things be different than they are. I can be much more compassionate with other people's suffering when I really understand my own and my own relation to the three marks of existence. So thank you for saying that.
Thank you for reminding me, was struck by what a beautiful thing it is that here we all are pursuing this.
Yeah, and then when you understand the importance of developing individual understanding, then you can see how profound it is to have a well-focused sangha. I say it often, and it might sound what's the right word? Self-aggrandizing because I'm sitting here, but it really isn't. We are so fortunate to have what's developed here in Frenchtown. It really is, I'm not going to say it's singularly unique, but it's rather unique in modern Buddhism and, if you want to use the word, modern spirituality. We have developed a well-focused sangha on, and it's not to say, we're not the only ones around, but we're very fortunate that these teachings that were first presented 2,600 years ago are just as alive today in this room as they were back then. So, and that's the sangha, that's not me. So, Mary, it's good to see you.
I fell off the wagon when I was away over Christmas, and I come back, and I'm trying to get back into the swing of things, and I do have to remind myself constantly when I am meditating that just to keep on, and not to give in to the temptation, basically, to come to fall prey to the thoughts that are trying to drag me all over the place,
yeah.
And remind myself again just to stick with it. When I get into a mood where I am mired in despair, I need to stop and think, this is not permanent. You will move on. And the same thing when I'm feeling good. It's funny, when I'm feeling good, I don't think about anything one way or the other. I just kind of go with it. Mm-hmm. And I need to learn to go with that, too.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing I'm going to do to change that other than just move forward and accept it for what it is. It's a bad moment, and there'll be good moments and bad moments, and you need to hold that in mind. I had a long conversation with a friend, and I'm trying to, get her to understand that she needs to just let things go, because she's just causing herself so much stress.
Yeah.
She really is. I'm so grateful to have this to make me understand that just let it go. It's going to go away anyway.
Yeah.
Just don't hang on to it.
Yeah, and Mary, you've developed, it's such a skillful framework for recognizing all these mind states are impermanent. But when we're really stuck in something, when it hurts, when it's really causing a lot of anguish in our minds, it feels like that's going to be our experience forever.
Yeah.
When you're in it, this is it. Mm-hmm. And because you've created a conditioned response to it, to use the phrase, you'll go to the death defending that feeling.
Yeah.
That this is how I feel. The world is responsible. Everything must change so that I can change the way I feel. Rather than recognizing it's a temporary mind state, and even if the agitation is rooted in reality, that reality is impermanent. Those things will change. There's no and Becky talked about that too. Everything is impermanent, no matter what it is. Why hold on to anything? Why be overly concerned about it? Why, another way of saying it, is why lose our minds over it?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to. We can stay at peace. And I know it sounds crazy to most people. You will understand it, hopefully. We can be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. It's simply what's occurring in my mind at this moment. It doesn't have to last unless I'm clinging another thought to it. But if I have a little bit of spaciousness and the right framework for seeing things, meaning recognizing the impermanence of all things, then I don't have to get any further upset over this. It's just what's occurring now. Be at peace with it. Sickness, aging, death, not getting what we want, getting what we don't want. The last thing the Buddha said in describing dukkha is, in short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. The five clinging aggregates, a simpler way of saying it is, the five clinging aggregates are clinging to views, clinging to self-referential views. That's what it describes. That's dukkha, holding on to these views that aren't based in reality. So, today's talk, we've gone a little bit longer in class, so it'll just be a brief introduction because you're going to read it. The virtuous factors. Let this go.
I'm just going to get my coat.
it's still okay. Well, we're going to be done in a few minutes. But, yeah, sorry for the coolness.
Turn it up high enough, I guess.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. I'm going to move the thermostat actually into this room, and that should solve the problem too. The virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path follow the wisdom factors of right view and right intention. And there's a logical reason for that. We've now developed an understanding that some of the views that I hold are self-referential views and they're not rooted in reality. That's the beginning of developing right view, recognizing that you have some views that are wrong views or unskillful views. And we've looked at of developing right intention, the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. the virtuous factors follow in a very practical way, because it is through being mindful of our skillful or unskillful, right or wrong speech, skillful or unskillful, right or wrong actions, same thing with livelihood, as we can be mindful of that. We need a little bit of concentration starting with meditation, but as we can hold in mind the unskillful or the wrong sides of speech, action, and livelihood, then we can recognize craving and clinging, because that's where it will become most apparent. Most of us, because of conditioned thinking, act in any way that we feel is appropriate, but not necessarily within the framework of the Eightfold Path. In other words, we might justify wrong speech or wrong action because of our response to what's going on around us. It might be with another person, it might be a situation. But with the framework of the Eightfold Path, we can recognize that those thoughts, words, and deeds that we once excused away in some way are still unskillful and still hurtful towards us in developing the Dhamma. So many times, I'm not going to say it's to a person, but most of my students, the first recognition they have of craving and clinging is speech, and when they start becoming mindful of right speech. In fact, when I teach children, that's really what I focus on is speech. And I'll say something like, do you notice when you're talking with one of your friends about another friend, you're not being kind? Do you notice how that makes you feel? And almost every kid has said, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I say, well, you don't have to talk that way. You can just not do that, and you'll feel better. And they'll come back to the next class and say, you know, I felt like gossip, but I didn't, and I really felt great at the end of it. That's an example of it. And it's a very simple example, but it's also very profound. Jiddu Krishnamurti, I don't know if everyone has heard of him, but some of you have, I think, was one of the great thinkers of our time. He died in the early 60s. But two of the things that he said, one was relating to the teachings of the Buddha. He says this is an authentic teaching. He wasn't talking about developed Buddhism. But he said, look at the lives you're living. And every talk he ever gave, and he gave thousands of them, he used that somewhere in a talk. Look at the lives you're living. And what that means is to use this framework. He wasn't speaking specifically of the Eightfold Path. But look at the lives you're living. Look at your speech, your action, the things that you're doing in your life, because that's a reflection of your consciousness. And that's why the virtuous factors are there. They're common. The reason why what the Buddha taught is often referred to as religion is because moral and ethical teachings are part of most religions. Not everyone, but most of them. So it has a religious connotation. But really the reason why the Buddha taught the virtuous factors is so we can recognize craving and clinging, because it's in our thoughts, words, and deeds that arises. And if we can develop mindfulness of that, then we can continue to develop the rest of the path. The reason why it's significant is if we are acting in a way that's hurtful towards ourselves or others, our minds are simply going to be too agitated to be able to develop concentration. We just won't be able to meditate properly. So the more that we can address our own behavior in relation to those virtuous factors, the more our minds will be at peace and the more we'll be able to deepen the path. So it's very holistic and synergistic in that way. It takes, like Kevin said before, it's not just seven factors, it's all eight factors that we need to look at. So your homework this week is to read that chapter on the virtuous factors, and then we'll discuss it next week, and I'll introduce the concentration factors next week. There was a few announcements I wanted to get to before we close. I've raised the requested donation to $15 this year. Don't anyone ever feel that if your financial condition doesn't allow for that, doesn't mean you can't come. It really is a requested donation. Please continue to join us. But you know, costs are going up. Got to pay the rent. The spring retreat is May 11th to the 14th, and I've been promising to have registration up, and I should in a week. My desktop computer was down. It's a little difficult to do all that on here. But so within a week, we'll have registration. Within 2 weeks, we'll have registration for the retreat. But you can put aside the dates. And the October retreat is up there, too.
What are the dates again?
May 11th to 14th.
Okay.
Thursday to Sunday.
Is there a specific topic?
Well, I might. The last year's Wisdom 1.0 retreat really worked out well. And I may just repeat that because you can always go deeper. But I'm also thinking of, I'm in the process of finishing up a rather short book on emptiness and how it applies to the Buddha's teaching. And if I complete the book in time, I might make it on that. But we'll see. It'll be a good retreat anyway. The Ron Dharma Center is a great place. There was one other I can't think of it. So much for concentration.
Yeah.
Let's we'll finish with the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth and take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of a fully awake and fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.